Hey, are you hungry? Well, you're in luck. Meat and Three is back for season 16. I'm Taylor Early, and we've got a whole new batch of reporters I am so excited to introduce you to.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Fisher.
Asha McElroy.
Sam Girardi.
Jessica Gingrich.
Hannah from Wisconsin.
I'm a swing dancing audio engineer.
I am a future registered dietitian nutritionist.
I'm from New York, and I love rice and beans.
My favorite food of all time is a shrimp burrito.
I love watermelon.
We've also got a bonus podcast for you called Behind the Internship. Three of our reporters will take you along to show how they develop stories for this very show, Meat and Three.
Hi, I'm Danielle Flitter, a plant-based chef from Philadelphia, living in Mexico City.
I'm Sophia Hooper. I'm a bartender based in Portland, Maine.
My name is Addison Austin Liu. I am a chef and food journalist from Salt Lake City, Utah, and my favorite food is Peruvian.
Rice and beans.
Hand-drawn noodle soup.
So tune in to enjoy a square meal for your ears. And I hope you saved a little room for dessert.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit korin.com.
I'm Damon Bolte, host of The Speakeasy. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hello, welcome to Japan Eats. I'm your host, Akiko Katayama, food writer and director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deep understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from our studio at Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deli and supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi ramen izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, and I try to demystify it in this program with my cool guests. And I have a special guest from Japan today. Elizabeth Ando, who was also on episode 18, is here again. And Elizabeth is a food writer and a Japanese cooking instructor based in Tokyo. She founded a culinary art program called A Taste of Culture, which offers a unique opportunity for non-Japanese people to explore Japanese culture through its food. And she's also the author of 6 cookbooks, including award-winning Washoku, Recipes for the Japanese Kitchen, published in 2005. And she was a Gourmet Magazine's Japanese correspondent for more than 3 decades and was a regular contributor to the New York Times travel section for many years. And in the last episode, she told us many interesting things about Japanese cuisine, such as 5 tastes, 5 colors, 5 methods. And today we'll discuss another essential concept of Japanese cuisine called Ichimoku Zenshoku, and also Tsukushi Kondate. I've never heard of anyone talking about them on American media, so it will be a great show. So hello, Elizabeth. Welcome back to Japanese.
Thank you. Delighted to be back again.
So first of all, for listeners who missed the episode 18, could you please tell us your background, which is pretty fascinating?
Well, I don't know. I was born and raised here in New York City many, many decades ago and got to Japan by a happy accident in the mid-60s and basically stayed. So I've lived most of my life in Japan. Early discovered the world of food, partly because I was looking for good things to eat myself and curious about how they were made, and began teaching other people in the 1970s. Mm. And ever since have been sort of a resource for people who haven't yet learned Japanese and they don't have access to information in Japanese about Japanese food and food culture. Mm. And along the way started to write for American publications as well.
Okay. Right. So you've been in Japan for 48 years.
Yeah, 49, something like
right.
that.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And the last episode, I learned so much from you. So today, I can't wait.
Thank you.
You are obviously more than me or even the food business people, I think, because your objective view to Japanese culture.
A different perspective, I think. Mm. Although born and raised in America, certainly most of my life has been spent in Japan. And I'm curious, so I ask questions that other people sometimes don't.
Yeah, you don't take it for granted.
No. And I think I can get away with asking questions that perhaps Japanese can't. Mm. and so I get the best of both worlds.
Right. Okay. So now let's talk about today's main topics. But before we talk about ichimotsu zenshoku and tsukushi kondate, I think we should talk about kansha, or gratitude, which is underlying idea of almost everything in a Japanese society. So how important is kansha or gratitude in Japan?
Very. And what's interesting is that kansha is not specifically about food. It can be spoken of about almost anything in Japan. You can be appreciative of almost anything. But when you are talking about food, kansha usually means two things at the same time. It means recognizing what nature provides and also recognizing how clever people are to use what nature has provided and to feed themselves and other people. So often it's the ingenuity of people that makes what nature provides edible, palatable, nourishing. Right. It would otherwise not be. And I'm constantly amazed at the amount of ingenuity and possibly desperation. There was nothing else to eat, so how can we make this, you know, nourishing? That people in the old days used in order to take seemingly uninteresting things and be able to make them into full meals. So kansha. And it is interesting that this time of year in America, well, Halloween is right around the corner, but just beyond that is Thanksgiving. And it is referred to in Japanese as Kanshasai, or the Appreciation Giving Thanks Festival. But certainly in Japan, although most things related to Japanese food have a very deep seasonal association, kansha is year-round. It has nothing to do with any particular time of year. I think it's a mindset that people have anywhere and any time. Whereas here, it's very concentrated sort of into Thanksgiving.
And I was thinking, you know, whenever you go to Japan and people eat, start eating, they say, itadakimasu, meaning thank you for this.
It's a simple verb on the one hand, meaning I receive or I get, but it has a very special and wide meaning, and much with many other words in Japanese that are aimai, they're not very specific. It can mean both thank you to the person who's made the meal and thank you to nature or the higher powers for having provided it. So again, that sort of double side to the notion of kansha. And it's very much evident, I think, in the Japanese kitchen.
The other thing is the craftsmanship, like food, for instance, like, you know, the kombu, there's like a really thinly sliced kombu and shaving. That's a technique. And I saw one person, he was shaving kombu like really thin, and that kind of culture, how did he survive for doing it? And it's just amazing, you know, there's appreciation for
and who thought to do that. I mean, some things you can observe other animals in nature and they're nibbling it and they seem to be okay, it's not poison, so maybe I, as a human being, should try to eat that. But certainly no animal was going to sit and marinate a sea vegetable in vinegar, wait till it got soft, harden it again, and then shave it. I mean, that was something that only people could think to do. And why did they do that? And how did it get to be that way? I'm not exactly sure, but it certainly is something I often think about when I'm using unusual ingredients, unusual meaning that most Americans certainly have never seen them. When I was writing my book called Kansha and wanting to use a lot of kombutsu, dried foods, partly because they weren't going to spoil, and I knew that people were unfamiliar with these ingredients, and they would buy them and maybe use them once, and it might be 6 months before they were going to use it again. And most kombutsu are okay that way. They're little friends waiting to be called into action whenever you decide to bring them out of the cupboard. But I realize most of them are really very interesting products that are the result of people's partly desperation need, but mostly their imagination to be able to think to use it that way.
Mm, right. And then, of course, it's deeply rooted in history, how it was evolving over time. And,
absolutely.
Right. But, you know, it's like for listeners who's going to Japan and then they... You know, you feel like you're Japanese, say itadakimasu before you eat, and people are like, oh, wow, you know the culture.
I guess so, but it is interesting. That's a word that a lot of visitors pick up on very quickly. Mm. Many of the people who come to my programs are not resident in Japan, but they're just visitors, and it's a happy accident that my schedule and theirs meet. Mm. And they come to a program, and we do sit down at table, and before anybody digs in, we say itadakimasu. And it's a word that most of them have heard before and have actually said. I mean, even in a restaurant, people have told them that that's what you say before you start eating. And I think that people are happy to discover that there's a simple way of saying thank you.
Right. Yeah, and it finished with when you finished a meal, gochisousama, thank you. It was a great feast.
Yes. Right?
So, yeah, so that's the whole mindset.
I think so.
Okay, so now what is the concept of Ichimoku Zenshoku?
The simplest way to express it, I think, in English is to use food fully. I sort of prefer that expression to no waste cooking. It's more positive because it's talking about using the whole thing. But Ichimotsu is one thing, and Zenshoku is to eat entirely. So any particular ingredient, they're all parts of it that are edible. Some vegetables, it's more obvious. Root vegetables that have actually the root it's still attached, the skin, the top, the inside, and each of those have a different flavor, a different potential for being used in cooking. And to be able to use it all, the Japanese will often put them together at the same meal, and but you don't have to. What I suggest that people do is I talk about kitchen habits, and there are a couple of habits that I would like people to get into.
Right.
One of them is to start saving the bits and pieces, the scraps, the peels. Eventually, if you're not going to be using them in 2 or 3 days, you can always throw them out then.
Right.
Why toss them into a compost heap to begin with when there might be the chance that you could use it for something else? I think one of the things that most cultures do with scraps is make stock. They throw it into a big pot with water and they'll boil it. And that's certainly fine. But there are so many other clever things that you could do if you're saving and accumulating those bits and pieces. And there are sort of three, I guess you'd call them master recipes, that I often have in mind. One of them is the equivalent of a puree or a soup, where instead of just trying to extract flavor and make a stock out of something, you might simmer it just until it becomes soft enough that you can make a puree. And a lot of people, even those who go to Japanese restaurants regularly here in America, partly because I don't think there are many restaurants that have suri nagashi, a pureed soup, on the menu. So they're not familiar with the fact that the Japanese indeed do have their own version of pureed soups. And sometimes they will have the addition of tofu or soy milk. Sometimes they will be flavored with a bit of miso. And they definitely have a very different taste. But the texture is familiar and I think comforting to a lot of people.
Interesting.
So even if your scraps are not particularly from Japanese vegetables, you could make a lovely pureed soup out of bits and pieces. And if you were looking for some accent that was going to be slightly different, you might try using soy milk or using a touch of miso or soy sauce in terms of finishing it off. But one of my favorite ways to use scraps is a dish called kimpira. And the initial name of that dish came from a character in a Japanese puppet play. Kimpira, who was a spicy fellow who was known for his bold actions. And
I did not know that.
Yeah. And the person who wrote it, Shikamatsu Monzaimon, the sort of Shakespeare of Japan, I gather also liked food that was spiced with shichimi, with different kinds of fairly hot spices, which is not always typical of Japanese food. But basically, it's almost anything that's cut into thin slices, briefly stir-fried, and then finished off with this blend of spices. And sometimes people, I wouldn't say they're disappointed, but they will comment on the fact that Japanese food is not as spicely, as not as definitively flavored as other Asian cuisines. It seems.
Wait, you don't cry, you know, like if you have a Sichuan, you actually cry literally. But wasabi, for instance, and shichimi, that goes more to your nose and burn, not doesn't burn necessarily to the
tongue. Well, Sancho was tongue tingling,
right.
I think.
That's right.
But even so, it's an accent rather than a major feature of a dish. And I think that the way in which those definitive spices are used in in classic Japanese food is as an accent rather than as an in-your-face, here I am, this is the dish, like it or not kind of thing. But for those people who are looking for more punch, that's the word that a lot of people use when they're describing this to me. It's lacking in punch.
Right.
If they're wanting a punch, often adding some shichimi togarashi, the seven-spice blend, will provide that. So this particular dish, kimpira, which is finished with that, seems to be immediately appealing. It can be done with pretty much any vegetable. Things that I commonly will save would be the peels of potatoes, carrots, daikon, celery. Celery is so expensive in Japan, unlike here. It's very, very cheap.
Right.
Yeah. And what else? Daikon, of course, turnips, anything in the turnip family. So you would scrub the vegetable, and you would, instead of using a vegetable peeler where you're barely wiping it off, you do have a use for that peel. So you take it a little bit more thickly and be able to shred it and stir fry it. Sometimes I use sesame oil for that.
Right.
And you're basically just wilting it with heat, maybe a little bit of soy sauce, a little bit of meeting the sweet sake. And then finally, this explosion of flavor at the very end.
Right.
So it would be a way of using food entirely, even if it were not at the same, meal.
For instance, I when I get the radish with the greens from the farmers market, I use radish for salad, and then I usually mix the radish greens with the sweet chard. They make the combination really interesting and more layered.
There's all sorts of things. The other day I was at the Union Square Farmers Market and happily noticed that the small Japanese turnips are here with the greens still attached. It's often hard, I find, in farmers markets, even in America, to find the greens still attached to the vegetable. In Japan, it's very common. That's the ordinary way, is the whole vegetable gets presented.
Right.
Here it's often cut off before it comes to the market, so you actually have to buy two things.
Right.
But yes, the greens can be blanched and made into another very common dish, ohitashi. It's sort of like steeping flavor. And basically, it's flavor because after you blanch the greens, you let it cool in dashi. And as it cools down, it sort of draws in the flavor, the umami flavors of the dashi. it could be kept in the refrigerator for a couple of days and then used whenever you have a moment.
Right. And I think you have the recipe of kimpira
on
your website.
So in preparation for today, when we were talking earlier, I said, can I create an extra page? And you said yes. So everybody should go to kanchacooking.com. Mm-hmm. And I have a workshop page. And the workshop page was just switched over to kimpira and using food fully. And you can download a recipe that's, think of it as a basic sort of master recipe. It does suggest that you use certain vegetables or certain scraps, but the same procedure would work for a lot of things.
Okay, right. Yeah. So that's the foundation of Ichimotsu Zenshoku.
Yeah,
right.
Indeed.
Okay, I'll put the link on the show page. So.
Good, thank you.
And so now, what's the benefit of Ichimotsu Zenshoku? Of course, it's you don't waste things.
I think the benefit is both personal, environmental, or community.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of personal, it's very interesting that often the nutrients are dispersed or not always concentrated in just one part of, especially for vegetables.
Mm-hmm.
So the leafy greens, for example, of turnips have different nutrients than the root itself,
mm-hmm.
and also different flavors, different textures that are possible,
right.
And so you're able to utilize a little bit and get a lot from it. You're sort of maximizing on what it was. In the old days, long before there was refrigeration or very swift transportation, so that you could, you know, fly in your ingredients from exotic locations, you pretty much had what you found in your immediate neighborhood within walking distance. And at any given time of year, it was probably only just a few things. So being able to take a single ingredient and find many ways of preparing it and preparing all of it was a way of utilizing your food resources to the best benefit,
right.
Of yourself and also of the environment.
Right. Yeah, and what people say, the best part of nutrition of, say, like an apple,
right.
or the fish even, that's between skin and the flesh.
Absolutely.
So, yeah.
I think so. And I think people will be surprised at how much flavor is concentrated in things that they just discarded.
Mm.
What they've been missing all these years.
Mm. So we should just take a look and one before you throw it out.
Think about what it might become. And there's always these little resealable, you know, bags that you can put things in and put them in the refrigerator.
Mm.
And so maybe you are busy, and 3 or 4 days later you come back and they're looking pretty sad.
Right.
You can always put it in the compost heap then, but before then, one of the other habits that I talk about is getting people to look in their refrigerator and see what they already have.
Okay, yeah, we'll get that later. And so I just remember, many people started to be more conscious about reducing waste for ethical, like ecological reasons,
yes.
that we talked, right? And then, for instance, Chef Dunbarber, at Blue Hill, the Blue Hill Stone Barns,
right.
held a special dinner series in 2015 called Wasted at Blue Hill in West Village. And he served amazing delicious dishes with ingredients that were normally wasted. And, for example, he served a very flavorful bread made of residual beer malt. That was so tasty. And stew of kale stems and ugly-looking potatoes. And I heard he collaborated with farmers, fishermen, and fruit processors who also felt guilty about wasting edible ingredients. So, and I heard food waste adds up to 6 billion kilos annually in the States.
It's amazing how much just a little bit of thought and a little bit of creative energy could do to utilize that. Don't know if now's the right time also to talk about byproducts. And, for example, when you're washing rice and saving that water.
That's a very...
Tobijiru. It's something that people are always amazed at when they come to programs. I actually save it in a jar because the sediment becomes almost like a paste. And it's wonderful for culinary purposes. There are things you can cook with that.
That it's like a pasta, boiled pasta water.
Yes. But also the sediment from Togi Jiru is a wonderful hand cream.
Wow.
And it deodorizes your hands. So if, so after you've like filleted a fish and you rub that on your hands, it takes away the odor.
Okay. And yeah, sometimes I use a toothpaste. It's chemical.
It's chemical, and then it's going to taste like peppermint. Right?
Exactly.
this is really neutral, and it also works for like garlic and other very strong smells that might be left on your hands.
Right. Yeah. So, listeners, when you wash rice,
right.
save the water.
Right.
So now, what is tsukushi kondate?
Okay. It's another sort of aspect of this Ichimotsu Zenshoku, we're using food fully, and that is to take an ingredient and create a meal from it. And what is interesting is the original Iron Chef in Japan was sort of not mocking, but using that as a basic premise for making a meal. And indeed, in the culinary arts in Japan, it's very common, not as a challenge per se, but for people to be asked to create a meal focused or themed on a single ingredient. Some of it is recognizing season and the fact that for some foods, shun, or that peak of flavor, is going to be very limited, maybe a few days or a few weeks out of the year, and then you have to wait another whole year before you can get it again. So you're really wanting to enjoy the moment, and one of the ways of enjoying the moment is to focus on that ingredient and use it in many different ways. Some of it probably had to do with limited availability. Again, at any given time of year in any given location, you might have had only a few things available to you.
Right.
And how could you possibly use them to best advantage?
Right. So, you know, I had a conversation with the kaiseki chef, and he said there are 24 seasons in kaiseki cuisine. And that means this, it's only a couple of weeks of this ingredients available. So you have to make the most of it. This the whole dinner themed under that specific ingredients.
I think so. I mean, even now, this trip, less than 2 weeks away from Japan, but I know when I get back to Tokyo, there will be things in the market that weren't there 2 weeks ago, and that some of the things I'm already going to miss.
Somehow I
didn't get my last chance to eat them. I have to wait another whole year. So, yes, just about every 10 days to 2 weeks, there's a real turnover.
Yes, I have to say that in September I was in Japan, and you know, only a short trip, but then it was you know, Pacific, sorry, it's summer. That was the best season. It's the fattiest, and they say toro of summer. So
I think it's better.
Yeah, I
prefer it.
And then it's only once for a couple of weeks, and every restaurant I visited, we have summer.
So what's interesting is that often, especially chefs, I think, will showcase an ingredient to showcase themselves, and that's really the best way. So not the chef who can bring in exotic ingredients and odd things or you know, challenge people's taste buds, but rather take very simple, basic seasonal ingredients and be so imaginative and so skilled that they can make that ingredient taste 12 different ways.
Right. So it's like, for instance, in the summertime, corn can be a soup, can be, you know, like roasted, or
I love tomorokoshi gohan to cook it into rice. It's absolutely wonderful.
The color is yellow and the white.
And by the way, when you're just boiling corn, boil it in togi jiru, in the leftover water from rice washing. It is so much sweeter.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Oh, it's really wonderful.
I need a tank for wash rice water. Right. Okay, so Yeah, let's take a quick break here. And when we come back, we'll talk about Elizabeth's special tips not to waste food in your fridge. So please stay with us.
Thank you.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. Korin is proud of their Japanese culture and traditions, but they want you to know that their products are not just for Japanese restaurants. Their knives and tableware bring out the best qualities of food from every culture and fit into every restaurant, from French to Pan-Asian to American. And that is why they're located in New York City, where people from every country in the world come to eat. Korin's unique store in Lower Manhattan is home to perhaps the most extensive collection of Japanese chef knives in the world, including Japan, plus the rarest natural sharpening stones and exquisitely designed tableware. They also host special events such as knife sharpening demonstrations and parties with New York's most famous chefs and restaurateurs. Korin is dedicated to this ideal, bringing the implicit and elegance of Japanese culture to your table, be it in your home or in the finest restaurant. For more information, visit korin.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japan Eats, broadcasting live from a studio in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Akiko Katayama, and my guest today is Elizabeth Sando, who is a food writer and a Japanese cooking instructor based in Tokyo. So I heard that before your husband retired several years ago, you lived a double kitchen life.
Right.
And maintaining homes in Osaka and Tokyo. And how did you manage not to waste food in two fridges?
It was hard. I never could remember what was in what refrigerator, and I was constantly moving back and forth and would eat more in cycles. Mm-hmm. So I would maybe be in the same kitchen for 3 or 4 days in a row and then leave and then have to come back again. And I would get into the habit, and it was one that I wasn't aware of, I don't think, before, of constantly checking out what I had. Mm-hmm. And not necessarily trying to remember, but each day sort of taking inventory. Mm-hmm. And then performing what I would call triage. I grew up in a family of medical people, mm-hmm. and there was often medical vocabulary being used for the most ordinary things. And triage is when you're sort of deciding which things can be salvaged, what can still be saved before it's going to be beyond repair or beyond help.
Right. So you prioritize how seriously that someone is injured or that
right. And so the same for the vegetables. How sad and wilted is that half a pepper in the back of the refrigerator that you forgot about? Is there still something that you can do with that, again, potato that's looking less than happy, mm-hmm. And what about some of those more staple seasoning ingredients? People often ask me about miso. Miso doesn't spoil, mm-hmm. but it certainly does lose its aroma and its oomph, its power, and there are ways of revitalizing it by infusing it with new flavors and making flavored miso pastes that you can make dengaku and slather on other things. So it's constantly being aware of what's in your kitchen, the refrigerator, the cupboard, and thinking about what kind of a meal you need to make. I think that in that regard, the sort of the very simple washoku, five colors, five flavors, five ways, is sort of a roadmap to getting from the kitchen to the table. Mm-hmm. And very quickly, at a glance, you can tell that, there's nothing yellow. And maybe a wedge of lemon would do it, or maybe I want to a yellow squash or something and add it to the meal. So it's a way of assessing what you have and imagining what you need to create from it.
Right. Okay. So, for listeners, you need to listen to episode 18 to learn the basics of five tastes, five colors, five mothers.
a bit of that. And can I share with readers that when Akiko first contacted me, I said, can I ask you what's in your refrigerator? And you said, okay. So tell everybody what's in your refrigerator.
So, yeah,
what we need to make a meal from.
What's been sitting? Half an up of cabbage and red onion peppers from the farmer's market.
Okay.
And collard greens.
Okay.
And a can of sardine.
Okay. The can of sardines I wouldn't normally have. I might have dried, you know, niboshi in my kitchen. But the sardines I would probably either make into something called skudani, which is a soy stewed. You can sort of give it extended shelf life, and it's a nice little condiment to have with rice or even as a beer snack afterwards. Anything that's going to be leafy green, the collard greens included, I probably would do in this ohitashi method where you briefly blanch it and then allow it to cool, but not just submerge it in cold water, because then it's going to taste like cold water.
Nice.
Instead, you're going to let it cool naturally in dashi. It's a very simple broth. And even if you don't want to make a complete dashi that includes the fish flakes and all the rest of it, even just a piece of kombu allowed to soak in water.
Right. So dashi can be made out of a kombu or the flaky bonito or the dried fish.
Right, or just kombu. If nothing else, just a piece of kombu sitting in water for a while has an enormous amount of flavor. And most vegetables will absorb the flavor of the liquid that they cool in.
Mm.
And so the collard greens will taste like better collard greens if they're allowed to cool in dashi instead of submerging them in cold water. And once you've done that, you can then finish them off in different ways. One of the simplest, I think, is to toast some sesame seeds and either grind them or even whole, just tossed on top. Or more of the fish flakes, if you want to roast them and put them on top. You can make okaka, is what it's sometimes referred to. But being able to blanch off the greens while they still have some life to them, where you can still sort of save their flavor and save their nutrients, and then have them available for several days in the fridge. Your half a pepper probably would be a great candidate for kimpira.
Interesting. You can make kimpira with the pepper.
Delicious. Wow. Absolutely delicious. So you can do it in just one color or three colors or whatever. And they could be very thin slivers. They could be sort of thicker strips, depending upon how much texture you wanted left when you were finished. So definitely go download the recipe for kimpira and
that makes sense.
And try doing that. And for cabbages, one of the easiest is what I call an impatient pickle or a quick fix pickle, because you don't have to wait for terribly long. It's basically giving it a massage with salt.
Like a really hand massage.
A hand massage, shio momi. And one of the easiest ways to do it without special equipment is to take probably the freezer bags are stiffer, so they're going to be easier to squeeze.
Okay.
Rather than the regular, you know, bags, that you, resealable bags. Chop up your cabbage. Also, cucumbers are great, or radishes, thinly sliced. Put them in the bag, toss in some salt, and then squeeze. And the amount of pressure should be the kind that feels good if you had sore shoulders. That's just right. So sort of think, maybe over here I want just a little bit more. And before you know it, you have some liquid that's coming out, the brine. And depending upon how strong you want the pickle, you could let it sit there for several hours, even several days in the refrigerator, and it would really develop flavor. But it's ready to eat. Rinse off the extra salt, squeeze it out, but it's ready to eat in maybe 10 minutes.
Wow.
So it's really an impatient an impatient pickle.
I'm going to do that tonight. Good. Yeah, I'm very impatient. I can't wait for eating.
The other, you can add other flavors to it. One of my favorite is ginger juice. Mm. So if you grate a piece of ginger and squeeze it to get the juice, and you add it to the bag after you get the liquid.
Mm, you get the kick.
Just a little bit of kick, a little bit of extra flavor.
Right.
So that's an easy set of things. But I would, so each time I would go back and forth living my tale of two cities in the two different kitchens, I would discover when I got back to the other kitchen, I thought I had cleaned it out before I left, but I always ran into some reason why I was in a hurry and I didn't. And so I would find these, what I call less than happy looking things in the refrigerator. And the first thing I would do is imagine how to salvage them, how to save them, how to give them another life.
So this knows triage. Triage, that's the word.
Yes, culinary triage. That's the way to go.
Right. Okay, so now I have to mention it. So because you're such a great, talented teacher as well. You recently released a wonderful Japanese cooking video program called Japanese Classics, Teriyaki, Tempura, and More with Elizabeth Sando on Craftsy.
Right.
So I already watched some classes, and they were super practical and useful. So I just suggest anyone who is interested in cooking Japanese food at home watch it. And maybe you can tell us about the program.
Okay, thank you. It was something quite new for me. I'm not used to being in front of a camera.
You did really well.
thank you. I became more comfortable as we were filming, and the people who were, the director was wonderful, Jared. But it was a whole new way of teaching for me. Mm-hmm. I was used to the written word and people having reference to it later, and I'm used to cooking live in person where it's really it's more impromptu. I have things planned, but they never turn out exactly as they were planned.
Mm-hmm.
And here there was an opportunity to really focus on technique and to be able to show people very simple, very effective things that are difficult to describe in just words.
Mm.
And they're difficult to describe with still pictures. They're really action.
Right.
And elapsed time. You can talk about 2 to 3 minutes and what you're looking to happen, the color is going to change or it's going to change. But being able to actually do it in real time on the Craftsy videos was really exciting. As a teacher, it was exciting, and it allowed me to do different things. And in their system, they have the ability to do a 30-second playback so that you can watch the same 30 seconds as many times as you need to see it in order to really understand. They were also great because they had cameras at different angles so that you could see, and we took one take. I would look at it and I'd say, no, I think it needs to be the other camera, and they would retake it.
Wow.
So it was really an exciting opportunity and something I had never really thought of doing before.
Mm.
Also, there's a Q&A. It is written, so there are typed answers to it. And it's interesting, the questions that people ask me. So anybody who signs on to the program can ask those questions, and I'll give you answers. And some of unexpected questions. So it's been very educational for me to see what people ask.
Okay.
Even though they're able to go back and look again.
Right. Well, one of the things, I saw the like little tricks, but very important tricks.
Right.
Like, you know, removing the bitter head part from dried fish. And, you know, people never pay attention that much.
And you can talk about it and you can tell people about it. You can have a still picture of it, but people still don't get it until
right, and
they
how
see
do you
it.
Remove that small part? It's that you showed it.
And my hands aren't messy. It's not grotesque. It's just, and it takes 2 seconds.
Right.
And it makes all the difference in the world.
So that kind of, you know, on demand, and you can really see it. Because, you know, it's reading cookbooks, sometimes drawing origami by reading it, which is way more complicated. But I really found this very useful.
Good. I'm glad. So it was fun to do and very educational for me as a teacher.
Okay. Yeah. But as a student, I learned a lot too.
Good.
So so where can we take the cooking classes?
The Craftsy? If you go to my main website, tasteofculture.com, there are links to it. And if you use those links, you get a discount.
Mm-hmm.
And Why not?
Right.
You could also go to craftsy.com and do a search for Japanese.
Right.
I'm the only teacher that's doing Japanese cooking classes.
Mm. Yeah, and I found it's a 6 classes, very basic, it covers everything. And only $25?
Something like that.
Right? Yeah. So I'm like, wow, that's to me, it's just without going to school. Yeah.
So. They're not necessarily the most interesting recipes, but they're very important ones.
Mm-hmm.
And there were certain things that they really wanted me to include that I was surprised. But it's a great collection. Mm-hmm. It's a very basic collection of recipes and techniques. It's very technique focused.
Right.
Yeah.
So the dashi and the rice basics, cooking with miso, salads and quick pickles, skillet skills, and deep frying, including tempura.
And also teaching people the word gaman and what that means. Not to mess with the food, that you really have to just wait sometimes, patiently.
Right.
Wait. Hard.
With respect.
It's very hard.
Right. Okay. All right. So I learned so much from you again today. So thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
So listeners, if you'd like to know more about Elizabeth's projects, please visit tasteofculture.com. That's one word, tasteofculture.com. And if you have any questions or comments about the show or suggestions for guests or topics of the show, please contact us at japaneseats@heritageradionetwork.org. And Japanese is live at 3 p.m. on Mondays and always available at heritageradionetwork.org, iTunes and Stitcher podcasts. And please go to iTunes and Stitcher and write a review. We really appreciate your feedback. And today's show is made possible by Corin, and our engineer is David Tassiore. And thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.